Coming up on today's show, with lots of young QBs balling out, is this the most fun the NFL has been in years? What's going on with Odell Beckham Jr.'s early season struggles? And we pour some out for season-ending injuries to Earl Thomas and Tyler Eifert, as well as the end of the Fitzmagic era. The Browns drop a heartbreaker on the West Coast. Hodbaker looking his first start. And what in the world is going on with this officiating? Plus, we're back with an incredible edition of Am I Trippin'? We pick our Tomahawk Studs of the Week and so much more on a jam-packed Monday edition of The Tomahawk Show.
Welcome to The Tomahawk Show, presented by Uninterrupted. I am your co-host, Andrew Hawkins, joined as always by my guy, future Hall of Famer, 11-time Pro Bowler, number 73 in your programs, number one in your heart, Joe Thomas. How you doing today, bro?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for that amazing intro. And of course, I've got to intro our two MVPs that are always with us. That, of course, is Natty Ice, who does sound production and just about everything else. She keeps us on track. How are we doing today, Natty Ice?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
I'm doing great. And then we need to throw it to the Zerminator. The firm, the man with
great nickname.
I accept the Zerminator nickname moving forward. And guys, I woke up this morning with a heavy heart, but other than that, I'm doing great. Yeah.
Join the club, firm. Listen, make sure you subscribe, rate us 5 stars anywhere podcasts are available. We drop new episodes every Monday and every Thursday, so you get a double dose of the Tomahawk Show. Before we get into the actual football talk, We've had some developments on NFD's whereabouts.
Oh, ooh.
My
ears have perked.
I got a credible tip on Twitter via DM from the Norwegian embassy. They said that he is alive and well. They would not divulge any further information, but they said that they have seen him alive and breathing. There is a situation that we are still getting to the bottom of, but he is alive. So there's hope. His family is super excited. We're obviously very excited here at the Tomahawk because we were worried sick about him. We just got to get him home. We got to bring NFD back.
Mm-hmm. Have we started that GoFundMe account yet to pay the ransom that the yes. Norwegian government has asked for?
That's our next step. We're going to start a GoFundMe. Make sure you donate. And this is not a scam at all. And it is 100% legit. And you can take that to the bank. So we'll start a GoFundMe. Give generously. And this will help bring NFD back to all his loved ones because people are a wreck without him.
All right, let's get to the show. After the NFD talk, I'm kind of sad. So I'm hoping that maybe we can talk about something that will boost my spirits a little bit. First segment, I think this is something new. Zerm, why don't you tell us what's going on here at the top of the Tomahawk Show?
Yeah, so we're going to start doing every Monday. We're going to call this segment Three and Out. We're going to quickly go around the league, three things that jumped out at us around the league from over the weekend to really get the energy flowing. It's early today. We're going to get our energy up, the blood moving. And so this is Three and Out. We'll do this every Monday morning.
Could we call this our 2015 offense? That way I can remember it easier.
Wait, which offense was that?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm having a hard time remembering which one was ineffective.
We have so many to choose from. Can we call this the Tomahawk Show? Because it seems to be the offense me and Joe do when we get together. Three and Out seems to be
that makes sense.
The third host. All right,
Hawk. Well, let's get right into Three and Out. My first question, and I'm going to give it to you first, is. Is this the most fun the NFL has ever been offensively?
Yes, it is. But it also sucks. And this comes from an offensive player. I think the rules that they put in place to, quote unquote, protect quarterbacks, a.k.a. babysit them, has allowed for stats like Ryan Fitzpatrick to throw for 400 yards in 3 straight games, has allowed for stats like 12 quarterbacks who have thrown for 400 yards already this season, which is the most in NFL history. Because guys are scared to tackle guys. It's given quarterbacks infinite amount of time in the pocket, so they're able to dice defenses up. And you don't even have to be a good quarterback anymore. There's guys who are not good quarterbacks who are dicing up defenses. Now, compare this to last year where the quarterback play was brutal. Maybe this is what the league wanted. Or I have another conspiracy theory. Maybe the league is like, all you guys care talk about is how everyone is getting concussions. All you guys talk about is how everyone's getting hurt. How about this? We'll take all the tackling out of football. We'll see how you like it. And everybody's like, ah, blah, 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 blah. And I'm one of those guys. Long-winded way of saying yes. The offense is so exciting, Joe.
Hey, man, I like that take, but I'm going to say the reason right now that offenses are exploding like we've never seen before is something that people are not thinking about and talking about, but there has been a significant infiltration of college offensive concepts and actually high school, because that's kind of even where it started. All this spread,
high school Harry's,
RPO, zone read stuff, that really started at the high school ranks, and it's kind of moved its way up to college, and now we're seeing the majority of college teams use it, and it's scoring tons and tons of points. But now you're seeing these good, smart, young offensive coordinators. They're incorporating a lot of these concepts into their schemes, and we're seeing a lot of those quarterbacks that did it really well in college that are coming to the pros that can throw, they can run, they can do all these different things. And so defenses are having a harder time because they've got to defend the field horizontally and vertically, whereas when I first got into the league, it was downhill running. It was guard pull, center pull, smash mouth football, inside zones. Now you're seeing teams like the Rams with Sean McVay and Jared Goff and Todd Gurley. They're running these outside schemes where these running backs are running right to the sideline and they're making everybody run, and all of a sudden the quarterback will pull the ball and they've got somebody running down the field 70 yards behind the defense, and yeah, Jared Goff tilts back and throws the ball down the field. So it's making things much more difficult on defenses because, like I mentioned, you've got 11 guys. The field's the same size. But now you have to defend all the corners. You can't just give up the outside zone type stuff where nobody ran that stuff 15 years ago. So that's my take. I think infiltration from college offenses is making a big difference.
In the NFL. Let me help you out there, Joe.
No, thanks, man.
No problem. That's what I'm here for. You know what? You're right, because, well, I don't want to say you're right. That's a good point, because I don't like saying you're right about anything. And the reason why I say it's a pretty good point is because if you look at it now, when people run those kind of bullshit trick plays, people call it innovation, where like 6 years ago, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, for us, when we seen plays do that, we're like, oh, they suck. That's what shitty teams do. They run early trick plays. So like Philly, which everyone seems to have in their offense now, where you pitch it 37 times and then throw it to the quarterback. Everyone has that play. Again, a couple years ago, we would be like, yeah, that team sucks because you got to do all that dumb stuff to try to get a first down instead of just lining up and running it down the pipe. And also, another underrated take is I think they waited until you retired to get fun, because you are about as fun as a fire hydrant. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, was really what was holding the NFL back offensively. The linchpin of failure.
Yes.
Not only in Cleveland, but throughout the NFL.
Throughout the NFL.
All right. That was first down. What's second down?
Second down. OBJ doesn't have a touchdown yet this season after a mega wide receiver free agent, not really a free agent, but a new contract, and he's the highest paid receiver. Do you think his new deal has played into his struggles? Yes or no?
It has not. I don't think it's affected him. I've been able to watch the Giants a little bit, and it doesn't look like OBJ is doing anything differently than he did in the previous few years. I just think it's a different offensive scheme, right? What they're trying to do, they're trying to get Saquon Barkley the ball a ton of times. And with Pat Shurmur's offense, a lot of times it requires a lot of underneath, shallow cross type throws. It's true old school West Coast. Eli Manning doesn't have that RPO. He can't run like a lot of these younger quarterbacks. And so it's the traditional West Coast where you drop back, you throw the ball quickly, a lot of short passes, trying to do a lot of that downhill running stuff. And I think that's just affecting OBJ's production, because he's not getting as many down the field routes. He's not getting as many of those deep crossers, those deep outs, those things that we were used to seeing under Ben McAdoo's offense. So I think that's just affecting his overall statistical output, but he's not playing any differently than before he got his new contract.
No, you know what? I like that take as well, man, especially since when you know, he's the big dog. Everyone's going to key on him. You watch Sterling Shepard, who's had a big game this weekend, because guys are keying on Odell Beckham, so it's going to open up the other guy. I think those touchdowns will come. A.J. Green had a huge game versus the Falcons. Now, A.J. Green, who is one of my guys, We played together in Cincinnati. He played at the University of Georgia. So he has like a big following down in Atlanta. He lives in Atlanta in the offseason. So I know he was juiced about that game. He scores the game-winning touchdown. He comes off on the sideline and says, "This is my city." As he's playing against Julio Jones and the Falcons. That. I love it too. They asked him after the game. He said, "This is why they pay me the big bucks." Is AJ Green underrated? Should he be in the conversation of best wide receiver in the league?
He should. He is clearly one of the best receivers in the NFL. If you think back a couple weeks to that Thursday night game that they played, that dude was unstoppable in the first half. He's big. He's physical for being skinny, but he's super fast. He's got great hands. And the reason nobody knows about him or nobody talks about him as the best receiver in the NFL is because he's quiet. Yeah. He's not like Antonio Brown. He's not going to pitch a fit on the sideline. He's not going to kick over a water cooler. He's not like OBJ. He's not a Hollywood guy. He doesn't want his face in front of the cameras.
Not going to hold out. Receiver,
that hurts you. It really hurts you. But I will say this to AJ. You're not making the big bucks, buddy. You need to look at those other receiver contracts because you're better than those guys and they're making way more money than you.
Well, he makes the big bucks compared to me. no, but you're right, man. I used to tell AJ, I'm like, dude, the squeaky wheel gets the oil, man. And it's funny because I always withhold him from that conversation because I feel like people will think I'm biased. That's what I will run into.
Well, you are biased.
I am biased, but...
But it's a good point.
But the numbers match up. Like, he has... If you compare him and Julio's stats, and again, we've done this before, and we did this last week because this was my one-on-one matchup for the week. He has 61 touchdowns over his career to Julio's 43. Now, Julio has more yards, but what would you rather have? Would you rather have the extra 1,000 yards Julio has in his career, or would you rather have the extra 18 touchdowns AJ brings to the table? That's a question you got to ask yourself.
All right, third down.
All right.
Earl Thomas looks lost for the year with a lower leg fracture, and he gave a little wave to the sideline on his way out. He gave him the bird. Did this end as poorly as possible for both sides?
Yes, it did. Well, it could have ended more poorly because...
Tell me, could you please describe the situation where it could have ended more poorly?
Because when he hurt his knee, the brakes could have went out on the medical cart, and it could have ran him over... fracturing his other leg and hit the head coach on the sideline, wiped out multiple players, and there would have been even more lawsuits. That would have been even worse than what happened. But this is pretty bad. And him flipping the bird, and I don't know who he was flipping the bird to. People are saying it's to the Seahawks sideline. It could have been a player on the field who was still talking shit to Earl Thomas after an injury. It could have been like a joking middle finger to the owner, like, "Ha ha, you got me this time." Kind of thing, which is probably
didn't see that one,
but yeah, this is bad, man. This is bad. This is why players hold out. I know fans hate it, and for whatever reason, the fans always take the sides of the owner. I get it. That's the way sports are constructed. But this is why you hold out. This is why this is why he didn't want to practice. This is why he didn't want to come to camp, because when you play football, there's a 100% injury rate, which means as long as you line up in the National Football League, it's not a matter of if you get hurt, you are going to get hurt. And Earl just knew his time was coming, and I feel bad for him because he's probably not going to get the money he deserves at this point.
You know what I was thinking about when I saw him being carted off the field on Sunday? I was thinking about put yourself in the shoes of like a high-stakes gambler, right? All right, so you're one of these guys in Vegas that throws like tons of money on the football games, okay? And in this football game, you had like $20 million on the Seahawks. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden – that out of that $20 million, you just lost all of it. Like the Seahawks, because of whatever the bet you had, stay with me here.
Okay.
Whatever the bet you had, you lost it, right? That $20 million, you just lost, right? Uh-huh. Which is astronomical total. That's essentially what just happened with Earl Thomas. Now, if you lost $20 million in a bet, do you think you'd be pissed off enough to flip somebody off, especially if that person had a direct impact on the outcome of you losing that $20 million? That's exactly what happened to Earl Thomas. Think about that, people. He was about to cash in, probably be the highest paid safety in the NFL. The Seahawks would not give it to him for whatever reason. You know, you could say it's salary cap. You could say it's they're trying to go younger, whatever that looks like. He was trying to get his market value. He was not able to get that. So he was, holding, withholding his services, trying to act a little bit like a turd. And when he got hurt, he has now lost $20 million in value. So essentially, he was gambling and lost a $20 million bet. And so he's a little upset, people. So yeah. I guess I've got sympathy for him being in that situation because of how financially terrible that situation was for him. Now, we get it. He's made a lot of money. It's not like he's going to the poorhouse from $20 million net value to zero. Mm-hmm. But I don't care who you are. $20 million spends the exact same way. And I believe that that injury to Earl Thomas has lost him probably $20 million.
Is there something in gambling where if you're, let's say you're at the blackjack table, that somebody else playing can ruin your hand?
Well, yeah, I'm not a big gambler or blackjack guy, but a lot of times if somebody takes a hit or doesn't take a hit when they're supposed to by like the rules of blackjack, everybody at the table can get upset if now the card that you were supposed to get went to somebody else and the card that you were supposed to get was a good card. It's total BS. I think it's baloney, but you know, it's one of those things that I guess when you're sitting at the blackjack table and you're on your 15th gin and tonic and your 75th cigarette, you're sitting there going, Andrew Hawkins, you asshole. That was supposed to be my card.
That was my card, Andrew Hawkins.
That was my card, you son of a bitch. And I hate your podcast, too. It your sucks.
Stupid podcast. Yeah, that's what happened to Earl Thomas. He had a great hand, and the dealer knew he had a good hand. He knew he had a good hand. And then the guy beside him did something like he's all hopped up on, I don't know, Mountain.
Hey, I got one.
He flipped the table.
He played the Austin Powers. He had a 3 and a 2 and he stayed.
Yeah, exactly. Ruined everything. All right, so let's move on to the Browns, man. This is the heartbreaker section of our podcast. Browns lose a heartbreaker to Oakland. They go up 28-14. All is well in Browns fandom. And then things happen that seem to only happen to Cleveland. Most notably, late in the game, after a couple of turnovers from Baker, who played pretty good for the majority of the game. He did have some turnovers, but late in the game, they overturned a first down call that would have sealed the game for the Browns, and they didn't call a blatant-ass fumble by Derek Carr in the Raiders, which, again, led to the fate of the Browns, ended up losing. What was the final score? 45-42 in overtime, because every game goes into overtime now in the NFL. So, Joe, give me your thoughts, man. I know you have so many thoughts here, and I do too.
Yeah. How do you unpack them all in 1 second? But my first thought, let's talk about the referees, okay? So two big calls that everybody's talking about. One is, like you mentioned, the spot on that running play where initially the Browns were given the first down, then they reviewed it and took it back. Now, I always like to give referees the benefit of the doubt. I know they're in a tough position. They have no sides, but both teams' fans hate them, right? So I feel like sometimes they get too much of the blame as an official. In this case, the only way I can give them credit is if somehow there was a view that they were able to look at that nobody else on planet Earth or any of the aliens on Mars were able to see. Because every view that we saw on TV, all the reviews that I've seen on the internet, on social media, clearly it shows that the ball, when the elbow hit the ground, was at least at the first down line, or at least at the very minimum, there was nothing clear and obvious to overturn where the ball was placed, and it was a really, really bad call. What's your take?
Yeah, no, I mean, I just don't get it. I feel like there are bigger powers that have stolen games from the Browns specifically. It hurts my heart that the Browns should be 4-0 this year. If we had a good kicker and just legit referees or legit objective calls, the Browns would be 4-0, and that's sad because this is a good defense. They didn't really live up to what their first 3 weeks of the season yesterday, but they put us in the position to win multiple times. And again, like late in the game, you want a defense that is going to say, okay, we're going to stop the bleeding. Or you have playmakers who say, we're going to make a play. We're going to make an interception. We're going to hit a sack, strip, fump, whatever that is. And they did that yesterday. And to watch it be taken away, man, that's like, it's heartbreaking. I'm sitting in the room. I watched the games with, name drop, Adam Schefter. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Oh, okay.
Love Schefter. The Hasselbacks. You know, the Mort Report. I mean, we're all in the room at ESPN watching these games. Wow. And they're all like, yo, this is BS. I can't believe this is going on. If you heard Tony Dungy last night, he sent out a tweet talking about how bad this was. Tony Dungy probably has three people that he has to call before he gets a tweet because he doesn't know how to use Twitter. So that tells you how passionate he is about it. And I love Tony Dungy, by the way. But yeah, man, it was really upsetting. Overall, I thought Baker looked good. And, you know, he threw a healthy amount of picks, which I like. that's how I know he was on the right track. But the best thing that you watch when you watch that game from start to finish, Baker doesn't look like a rookie. He looks like a quarterback who's in command of the offense. He knows this offense in and out. It never looks like he's like, oh, I'm not sure what to do here, or man, what did the coach tell? He's in control. Even the plays, maybe he doesn't know it as well as we think he does, but he's such a football player. He's such a competitor. You can just tell he's going to create time. He's pointing guys in a scramble drill. Hey, go this way. He's making those throws, man. He's taking his chances, and sometimes it bites him in the ass, but that's what you want in a quarterback, because if you ain't trying to win, you ain't trying.
Every rookie quarterback that I've ever played with has three big problems early on, and this is part of the reason I've got so many scars from rookie quarterbacks, right?
Left tackles, bad picks, bad receivers, right? Two, and what's your last one?
There we go. So rookie quarterbacks, they're turnover machines, fumbles, interceptions mostly. They throw bad balls into bad coverages. They just make those boneheaded mistakes that veteran quarterbacks don't make, right? That's not physical problems. That's, okay, it's cover two, and I didn't know the corner was going to fall off, and I threw the ball right to the flat, right into the corner's hands. All right, penalties. All sorts of penalties on the offense because they can't get everybody lined up. They can't get it organized. They can't get the play in. They can't get the play out of their mouth. These things are things that I think most NFL fans take for granted, getting everybody lined up, getting the play called. But it's something that's actually kind of difficult because you've got a long play that's maybe 6 or 7 seconds that takes to say it, and you only have 12 or 13 seconds total to get into the huddle, say the play, get everybody lined up on the line of scrimmage, get them in the right spot, start the formation, start the shift. So this is something that has to happen without any hesitation or stuttering. And rookie quarterbacks, a lot of times, they struggle with that, but I didn't see that at all from Baker.
Yeah.
And the last thing is sacks. Rookie quarterbacks are indecisive. They have a hard time deciphering the coverages, the defenses, the blitzes, the checks. They really struggle, and everything is slower in their heads. So they take a lot of sacks. They get back in the pocket, they jerk the ball off, and they get sacked, right? Mm-hmm. Another thing that we didn't see Baker do in this game, he had two interceptions, and the first one was a tip ball. The second one, he was just taking a shot down the field. You could say he shouldn't have taken that shot, but in my mind, I like the shot he took because it gives you an opportunity for a pass interference.
Yep.
I think that's what he was thinking. Either a 50-50 ball, maybe a pass interference, puts you in position to score right there. I think it was right at the end of the half, right?
It was at the end of the game, I believe.
Or was it right at the end of the regulation?
It was tied. This is the last 30-second drive. Yep.
It was at the end of the half. The second half is what you should have said. Okay. So anyway, so those two interceptions, I'm okay with both of them. I don't think those are on Baker. I think they were good decisions. I didn't really see him make a lot of bad decisions. There was a couple times you saw him kind of – things broke down, and he went into, like, college, I'm going to try to make a play mode. Mm-hmm. But it didn't hurt him because he's so good at making those plays that even though things kind of broke down and he had bad mechanics, he was kind of, like, sidearm it in there. Mm-hmm. He was doing things – still effectively and conservatively. It wasn't like it was breaking down and he was just chucking the ball to the Raiders. So good job on that. You didn't really see many penalties in the game. They were very overall, they were really efficient getting in and out of the huddle in a loud road environment. That can be really difficult for a rookie quarterback dealing with the silent count, something that they probably haven't practiced a ton. I thought overall it was really good. And he only took two sacks. So that means he's decisively going through his progressions. He's throwing the ball accurately. He's throwing the ball on time. So out of all the things that rookie quarterbacks usually struggle with, Baker did none of those things. Now, here was the one issue, big glaring issue that I saw with what Baker did on Sunday. And that was in that bad snap that you saw between J.C. Treader, the center, and Baker. It looked like Baker wasn't ready. The ball came. He didn't have both his hands under the center, and they fumbled it, turned it over to Oakland, where they got one of their short field touchdowns. And I'm going to tell you what happened, right? From an offensive lineman's standpoint, this is something that Hawk probably doesn't know anything about because you just looked at the ball and you went when the ball moved, right? So you didn't have to know anything about the snap count, right?
Nope.
On the road, even under center, a lot of times it's too loud to hear the cadence. So what you do is you go on this snap count that's silent, which is everybody looks at the center's head, and when he lifts up his head, essentially, then there's a certain pause based on whatever the silent cadence is, and then he snaps the ball. And the only issue with this that a lot of rookie quarterbacks don't understand is once the mechanism to start the silent count has started, you can't stop it. Because what usually happens is a lot of times the center or the quarterback will come under the center, he'll tap the center's hip, and at that point, it's like mousetrap. He's like started that first part of mousetrap, and it's going, and you can't stop it. What you saw Baker do, he put his hand on J.C. Treader's hip, so he started the mechanics for the snap count, but then as soon as that happened, he realized he wanted to change the play or he wanted to move somebody. I can't remember if there was a shift or a formation issue, but at that point, he needs to know that that snap is coming in the next 1 to 1.5 seconds. Mm-hmm. And he needs to put both hands under there because that thing is coming and there's no way to stop it because you can't verbally communicate to your center in the middle of the head bob that you're not ready, that he needs to pause. So I'm going to say that that fumble that we saw on the snap was Baker's fault. And that was just a rookie move, not being used to being in the silent cadence and especially not being used to being under center. Because if he was in the gun and he would have been doing that, I think the ball would have been okay because it may have hit him, but he would have been able to grab him. Mm. But when you're under center and you've got only one hand under the center's
butt
area, you have no way to catch the ball. And a lot of times it'll fall and it'll just roll right to that nose guard because the center is not seeing the ball. So he can't grab it if it's between his legs. The only people that can see the ball usually are the quarterback and the defense. And in this case, it went to the defense and then they scored one of their basically game winning or game tying touchdowns.
Was he in, he wasn't in shotgun, right?
No, he was under center. And so, that's what I'm saying. Like it makes it more difficult doing silent count under center because you need to have both hands under there to be able to receive the snap versus if you're in the gun and the ball comes to you, it hits your body or hits your hand, you can quickly grab the ball because you got about 4 yards before the defense gets to you because you are further back from the line of scrimmage.
So I've heard this before from Lyman, and excuse me, this is a very wide receiver take, and I'm going to take the
– Good, we need those.
The devil's advocate of the fan here. What kind of drugs – do the linemen take where they can't feel 10 fingers under their crotch area?
Yeah.
Why is it so numb that they can't say, wait a minute, there is not two hands there where there shouldn't be two hands, and they snap the ball anyway? That's just the devil's advocate from the fans' perspective, Joe. Talk to me about it.
I'm glad we've got a guy that's never taken a snap or watched a snap being taken in his entire life, because when you take a snap, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but the top hand goes in that nether region. Mm-hmm. So the back of my palm is resting comfortably on the underside of the center's, his undercarriage, right?
Okay.
But the second hand is not also resting on the undercarriage. The second hand is underneath the first hand. So it's not touching the center's any area. It's just kind of floating in midair. It's almost like alligator jaws. So if you've got that top hand, that's all that center can feel. He's not going to feel that bottom hand. And if you saw that bad snap in the game, Baker actually didn't have that bottom hand all the way in there. And that's why
he still had the top hand.
He had the top hand in. But the bottom hand wasn't in because he was trying to change the formation or he was trying to change the play. I'm not exactly sure if somebody wasn't lined up right or what.
Yeah.
But that bottom hand wasn't in there. And that's the one that can actually alligator jaws chomp on and squeeze that football.
That's where the butt chomp comes from. Okay, yeah, got it. You know what?
Really detailed there.
Yeah,
we went way deep into snaps.
No pun intended. We went deep on that one. we should probably put I think, not for audiences under 18.
Yeah, we lost a lot of viewers in that little 5-minute soliloquy.
Hard tell off at the Tomahawk Show right there. to the point about Baker, the thing that hits me most about Baker's performance and watching him play is, again, we talked about his command of the offense, and you could just not even just this offense particularly, but just offense in general. Like, I feel like you could put him in any offense and he's going to have that same wherewithal at the quarterback position. And one that, like you said, most quarterbacks that have come through Cleveland haven't had. I mean, if you look at it, I want to say Couch had it. Derek Anderson had it for a little bit. Colt McCoy had a good feel for it. Even Brian Hoyer had like kind of that football mentality, the understanding of the offense, the playmaking. Hey, we're going to do this. If this doesn't work, this is how we move forward because I'm a good quarterback and I have command of this offense. The only difference is Baker has more ability than those guys. And even all the new young guys that you see on this football team, and this is shouts out to John Dorsey, because they're really good. You know what I'm saying? Like, you look at Antonio Callaway, he has some things to correct from the wide receiver position. When I'm watching him, the way he's trying to catch balls in traffic, there are certain things he can do better. He's going to learn. He's just so he has so much natural ability, even on the interception, like the kind of changing his track mid route to where he got his head around like late because he wasn't sure to go up under Reggie Nelson or go over top of Reggie Nelson. But he's got to know that that ball's coming out. Once Baker sees the angle you're at, whether there's three guys there or not, and you can argue he shouldn't have made the throw, but once he sees with the angle you're going, he's letting it go. So Callaway has to pick a side. That way he can get eyes on it and he can know, okay, this is either going to be a jump ball between me and Reggie Nelson, or I'm going to be in position to make sure it's an incomplete or bat it down. That's what should happen. But those are little things that'll come. If you look at just base ability, Callaway has it. Chubb, I mean, we talked about in the draft was getting – what was the other Chubb's name? I don't even remember the dude anymore.
Bradley.
Brad Chubb. That's the Chubb they wanted. We got the right Chubb.
We got lots of Chubb.
We got the Chubb we needed on draft night, Nick Chubb. And what was the stat? He was the first running back for the Browns since 1963 to rush for 240-plus yard touchdowns since Jim Brown.
That's what a random ass stat.
Super random, but shout out to the Tomahawk researchers. We are stepping it up, baby.
Chuck, man, he's the best.
Yeah, bro. Chuckled is our research guy. He doesn't wake up before 9 a.m., so we don't have him here live on the broadcast, but shout out to Chuck in the research department.
Here's a real quick comment about Nick Chubb. Did you see the speed that he had once he broke out into the open field on the long run? That was impressive to me because he was not a guy that that stuck out to me as super speedy. He's a big physical back. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, he's a lot like Carlos where he's going to kind of slug it out inside. And if he breaks it outside, it'll be a 20, 30-yard run. But he's not going to run away from any DBs. But was I wrong?
You were
wrong. He got an open field and he just took off. He had that – I'm not even going to say second gear. I'm going to say like fifth gear. Dude. He had that Ferrari gear where he all of a sudden, you know, Hawk knows all about those Ferraris. Got four of them in his garage in L.A.
Yeah.
He had that eighth gear, and he took that thing to the end zone. It was amazing.
That's what I thought, too, man.
He wheeled his tires at 100 miles an hour like you do on that 101 in L.A.
Exactly, man. Right down the 101 in rush hour traffic. But, yeah, I'm like you, man. I thought him and Carlos Hyde were basically the same guy, which I'm like, well, they're, like, very similar. So Duke will get a lot of the speed action. But not just that, when he made the safety miss, when he like gave him the boom, 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 1-2 step and hit the outside, I'm like, oh man, now this guy is kind of the complete package. So I'm excited to see him get more involved because it's going to be hard to not get him more carries after a performance like that.
That's a good point. That was one of my takeaways at halftime that we posted on the Tomahawk social media page at Tomahawk Show. Said, hey man, let's get Nick Chubb some more carries. I know a lot of times as a fan, we look at a guy that has a couple good runs or he has a good catch and we're like, wow, we need to get this guy involved more. And then from the coach's standpoint, they're like, well, he doesn't know what he's doing, right? He doesn't know the pass protection. He doesn't understand the holes. And what you see is his raw talent. You're not seeing him doing things within the confines of the offense. But I got to think Nick Chubb is a smart guy. I feel like he's got to have a pretty good handling and understanding of the offense. I would love to see him get some more carries because he is a fun player. And as you said, shout out to John Dorsey for picking the right Chubb and sticking with that Chubb.
That's it, baby.
This episode is brought to you by HP Plus. In a world full of smart devices, shouldn't your printer be smart too? It is with HP Plus. These printers know when they're running low, so you always get the ink you need delivered right when you need it. Plus, you save up to 50% on ink, so you can print whatever you want, as much as you want, anytime you want. Huh. That is pretty smart. Get 6 free months of Instant Ink when you choose HP Plus. Conditions apply. Visit hp.com/smart for details.
Hey, I got a question for you, Hawk.
Hit me.
As a former player, how do you move on after a game that clearly the officials, if you're not going to say stole it from the Browns, had a major impact on losing a game that you played really well, and generally I'm going to say everybody in that Browns locker room was going to feel like they should have won that game. How do you move on next week, right? Because they're going to have another game next Sunday. They can't sulk on this loss for too long and let this game beat them twice.
Yeah, that's a good question. My answer is this. You have to cling to what you've been preaching the entire time, which is this is not the Browns of old. And this goes to the fans as well. Yes, there were two very, very shitty calls that probably determine the game. And yes, this has happened before. And yes, it's hard to get into these close games, late in games, and watch this happen and say, man, they're always doing this to Cleveland, or here we go again. But you have to change that mindset. If you watch this team, and I was watching the game yesterday, you could not help but be encouraged, because this was a legit football team. This is, looks like a complete Cleveland Browns football team, one that we haven't had. It has the right amount of talent. It has the right guy at quarterback. It has the right defense. It has the right play callers. So you have to not just preach it, you got to believe it. And that goes for the guys in the locker room, where they had to look each other in the mirror, look each other in the face and say, yo, okay, the ball didn't fall our way this week. We got some bad breaks. We cannot let that linger, because we still have 12 other games that we got to go out here and fight for and win. And we can win because we have the talent and the football team to do so. We're not going to let them determine what our final outcome is. We're going to take control of it, take it week by week, and just keep it moving. And that's the same with the fans as well.
The Browns scored 42 points last weekend. How awesome is that? If you're a Browns fan, that is an exciting team. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say the first couple weeks of the season, that offense did not look like that. It was all defensive driven. That's why they were in those games.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, a 42-point explosion, and not even close to being a finished product. I mean, so many plays were left on the field, but that is an exciting football team. And I think that really talks about how great things are to come in the future for this team. I'm going to talk real quick about that young team issue. And I think we're going to find a lot about the Browns when they go back home next weekend in to play against the Baltimore Ravens, who came off a big win last night against the Pittsburgh Steelers. We're going to see if they can bounce back. We're going to see how quickly they can flush a game that's disappointing, because a lot of times it's easier to flush a game that you get blown out in versus a game that was really close and you feel like you should have won and the refs took it away from you or something unfortunate happened, right? And I think, to me, the way you do that, if you're a coach, it's all about teaching the process. The process after a game on that Monday morning needs to be exactly the same, no matter if you win or you lose. You get in there, the coach addresses the team, talks from a 10,000-foot view of, all right, these are the five things we did well. These are the five things we need to improve on: offense, defense, and special teams. Showing the plays good, showing the plays bad. Then you break up. You talk about it with a workman-like mentality. You have that blue-collar, all right, what did I do wrong? What do I need to correct mentality? You don't get too high if you win. You don't get too low and beat your players down when you lose. You teach that process so that every Monday is the same, and then when you come back on Wednesday, you're not even thinking about what happened last weekend. You've learned from your mistakes. Mm-hmm. You've put it into your brain. You've gone through that process on Monday afternoon where you corrected those mistakes. A lot of teams will go out and they'll have a walkthrough where all the plays that were done wrong from the game, they'll actually go and do a perfect play. So you're actually locking in the right way to do those plays on a Monday morning. But then Wednesday comes and you're all moving on to the next week. That was like the big thing with Belichick. Remember, on to Cincinnati. We're on to Cincinnati.
Yep.
That's teaching the right process. And we'll find out a lot about the Browns with how they play against the Ravens this weekend.
I mean, look, for anybody listening, make sure you head over to theathletic.com/tomahawk, all lowercase. It'll be good for 40% off your first year subscription, because the guys over there, and I don't understand how they do it, but they get some of the most back channel underground conversation between players. You know, there's an article on there now where it has, you know, Joel Batonio's wife's reaction to the missed calls by the Browns. It has Jarvis Landry's take on the ref saying how the calls are garbage. I mean, seriously, these guys really get the knowledge that you just don't get anywhere else, man. They're journalists who are really fans of the team.
You know, I always thought during my career, Hawk, that there were two type of written journalists, and those are the ones that, A, they go with the big group to whoever, like, the person was that had the big story or the big game, and they get there in a group, and then the group asks all these questions, and they get their quotes that they need, and then they insert those quotes into the article that they've already written for the game, right? So you kind of get the same article from everybody that's in that big group. And then there's those guys that like to slink and sulk through the locker room by themselves, and they develop relationships with all these different players. So then they can get the realistic quotes and realistic thoughts from all these different players. And after they get that, Then they go back and write their story. Now, those are the guys that have to stay up all night writing the stories. But in my opinion, they're typically the ones that give you a much better reaction from the players and a much more realistic picture inside that locker room. And The Athletic is the second type of media journalists. And that's what we see from this article here from Jason Lloyd. You get so many in-depth, in the locker room quotes that you're just not going to get in that big media time. So
right.
Definitely, if you have not subscribed to The Athletic, which is theathletic.com/tomahawk, 40% off in the first year, like Hawk said, it's a subscription-based publisher of smarter sports coverage for diehard fans. And their model is simple, right? No ads, no pop-ups, and no autoplay videos. So if you're going to pay that $2.99 a month, it's worth it just to not have those ridiculous ads and pop-ups when you're trying to read an article.
Yeah, and it's good for us because our take is always from the perspective of the players, because obviously we played the game. So when we read these articles, it gives us like kind of a real glimpse into what they are thinking. And we could say, oh, hey, here's what Jarvis said. Oh, hey, here's what Joel said. Here's what Baker said. And then we can decipher that and spit it out on our podcast, understanding what their mindset is. So instead, readers subscribe for authentic, in-depth coverage, which is written by journalists and the guys who are also fans of the favorite teams that you're a fan of.
Yeah, so we read the article and then it makes us sound smart when exactly. We really don't even know what the hell's going on. But the cool thing about The Athletic is they've got some incredible NFL writers on the national stage, Jay Glazer, Mike Lombardi, Lindsey Jones, and many, many more. But then they've got local guys because they put somebody in every NFL locker room that's beaten the pavement. And mm-hmm. In Cleveland, that's Jason Lloyd, who I think, incidentally enough, just put up a new article this morning.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much a reaction from the locker room of how guys felt about the missed calls, between the fumble by Derek Carr, the reverse first down, which it was supposed to be irrefutable evidence for a reversal, and that was not there. It should have stood. But yeah, I mean, again, head to theathletic.com/tomahawk, all lowercase, 40% off code given to you from your guys, the Tomahawk, Andrew Hawkins and Joe Thomas. All right, let's move into another portion of Browns talk. I got another question for you, Joe. What was up with the Dear Baker segment that ESPN did with Johnny Manziel? Did that seem like the most random, out of touch piece that you've ever seen around the Browns?
Yeah, I got to be honest. That was a little strange. When you brought it up, I truthfully didn't even see it during the game, because a lot of times during commercials or like pregame, I'm nursing babies and taking kids to school on Sundays. It's crazy around here, you know.
Taking kids to school on Sundays.
Yeah, nursing them, taking them to school, all sorts of stuff like that. So I don't always see all the commercials. But you asked me about it yesterday, and I was like, what are you talking about? And so I quickly went on the internet and I saw it. And the first thing that came through my mind was confusion. I'm like, where did this come from? Like, who right now is comparing Baker Mayfield to Johnny Manziel? That was like January 2018, before Baker Mayfield came on the Tomahawk Show. And I made it clear to everyone that was listening that Baker Mayfield is not Johnny Manziel. They are totally different quarterbacks. Yes, they're short. Yes, they're both from Texas. Yes, they are very energetic.
Yes, they both won the Heisman.
A little bit over the top on the field. But to me, the things I see from Baker that make him polarizing are things that are really good. Yeah. You want your quarterback to be excitable. You want him to be energetic, to be a leader, to be competitive.
And you be a great dancer. Baker. To be able to do the Dougie with the best young dancers in hip hop. Those are good things.
I mean, those are good things. That's how a guy like Baker can connect with old dancers like Andrew Hawkins. Yes. I mean, how else are they going to connect mentally and physically in the locker room unless they're breaking it down to the Dougie? So anyways, we digress. But nobody out there is saying, yeah, Johnny's just like Baker. And nobody out there is going, hey, you know what would be great for Baker is if Johnny Manziel could mentor him and all the things that he did poorly, because Baker is not a partier. He is, and that's what brought Johnny down, was his lack of dedication and his partying and his lack of seriousness towards his job. Baker's the total opposite. Baker doesn't like the party like that.
No.
Yeah, maybe he goes and has beers and tries to run away from cops when he's underage.
Yeah, we all do.
That's what Hawk did when he was at Toledo, and he still made it to the pros.
I did that last night.
He did that last night in L.A.
I got caught even faster than Baker did. One real quick, can we just shout out to Baker Mayfield? Because that arrest video is still my favorite video in the history of arrest videos. That's how I knew I love Baker, because he's ready to risk it all, man. He's ready to.
Yeah, but I thought it was kind of weird. And we love Johnny as much as anybody on this show because we were his teammates and we wish him well. But it almost seemed like a hollow attempt. And I don't know if it was Manziel's people or if it's ESPN, but trying to insert Johnny into Baker mania, right? And I'm pretty sure that everybody in Cleveland has forgotten about Johnny by now. And I think that's been a good thing for them. I think everybody in Cleveland has a lot of scars from the Johnny Manziel era. And they're happy that they have forgotten about that, and they're just focused solely right now on the great things that are happening at quarterback by the name of Baker Mayfield. And the last thing they want to do is be reminded about what a disaster Johnny Manziel was when he was in Cleveland.
The timing just seemed like a kind of a cheap headline grab and just clickbait, but there are some similarities. Let's not, like, they're not the same person, but yes, there is some overlap. There are some similarities that people who say there are none, that is not realistic. Here's my issue with it. The timing was just terrible. Like, this is, Baker is doing amazing. People are so high on Baker. It did not seem like a time for a piece about Johnny giving advice to Baker, because already in a really good spot. Like, from the
start. What advice is he going to give? Johnny had essentially one, what I would say, winning performance in Cleveland. I don't know what his record was, but the one game I could say, wow, Johnny was a real playmaker and he did great in Cleveland, was that Tennessee Titans game where he was able to avoid a sack at the end of the game. He rolls out and he throws a touchdown pass. We beat the Titans. But other than that, I don't think that he did much good at all when he was quarterback in the Browns. The only thing I remember him for was the bad that he did on the field with the turnovers and the struggles he had in practice, you know, learning the plays and understanding the playbook. And that just spoke directly to his preparation. And he'll tell you that from his own lips.
Yeah, I know. I agree, man. And again, I love Johnny. It just didn't seem like, it just seemed so like too random. But also shout out to Johnny, because he threw his first two touchdown passes in the CFL. One was a dime piece too.
Really? So yeah. I know you're a big CFL fan after all those years you had in the CFL. So
I get a CFL pension. How's
he doing right now in the CFL? I heard initially it was not well.
It was not well. It started off rocky, but he's doing like much better. He's improved. He threw his first two touchdown passes. He had a pretty good overall game. And the thing I'm proud most about Johnny is that he's continuing. It's going to be a hard track back if back is indeed even a possibility to the NFL, and he's stuck the course. I hope that he continues to do so, man, because, you know, he had the world at his fingertips. And when that happens, when you pass up on those opportunities, when you don't take advantage, you got to work three times as hard to get back to square one. And that's what he's doing, man. But he started out rough, had a great first game, had a great game last week. We'll have to check in with comeback season here soon. All right, let's get to some of the other NFL stuff. You know what? Let me take this time to break some unfortunate news, which is the end of one of our favorite eras here on the Tomahawk, and I have an obituary to read. Here lies the Fitzmagic phenomenon of 2018, which was born in week one of this NFL season and unceremoniously died of ineptitude in week four of this very same season. Fitzmagic of 2018 is preceded by the deaths of Fitzmagic of 2015 and Fitzmagic of 2011. In a time like this, we're not going to remember the Magic Man for his three interceptions he threw in one quarter of a primetime game last week, or for scoring a mere 3 points to the Bears 35 in his last half of football action, but for the records that he broke, which was three consecutive weeks with 400 yards passing, for the faces he made when he scored, which can only be done by weirdos from the Ivy League, and for the jackets that he wore with just the right amount of chest hair. Rest in peace, rest in backup to the Fitzmagic man, Ryan Fitzpatrick. Moment of silence. Okay, so yeah, that does it for Ryan Fitzpatrick. Am I right on my take? I gave a take last week that Jameis would play in week four. Now, he didn't start, but he did come in. Do I get a W for that take?
I think you do. Both of them played similarly poorly. Jameis had two interceptions, got sacked a couple times.
That's healthy.
His completion percentage was better, 16 out of 20, 145 yards. Ryan Fitzpatrick was terrible. But it's interesting. The amazing thing about the Fitz magic phenomenon was not only how he plays, but it's like the whole team either plays really, really amazing lights out with him or just horridly dreadful with him also on the bad side. You gave up how many points to the Bears? I'm not saying the Bears are horrible on offense because they're way, way better than they have been, but you gave up 48 points to the Bears. 48. And I think Mitchell Trubisky will be a good quarterback, but I don't see him right now as a top 10 guy. And he threw 6 touchdown passes on you guys.
6 touchdowns. Shout out to Mitch. You know Mitch Trubisky is a Tomahawk listener, by the way.
Of course he is. He's a big fan. He's a big NFD fan too. I think he'll be donating big bucks to the GoFundMe to try to find
him. Make sure we tweet him the link. But I seen him at the Super Bowl. And you know, I'm a very unassuming guy, so I never
false.
I'm 5'7". Guys don't look at me and say, "Hey, there goes that guy from the NFL," especially a young guy that I had no interaction with. I was at the Super Bowl week. Mitch Trubisky comes and taps me on my shoulder like, "Hawk." I'm like, "Hey, what's up, Mitch Trubisky?" He's like, "Yo, man, I just want to tell you I love the podcast, man. Like, it's funny as hell. I listen all the time. I got to come on. I got to make sure I'm barreled down in my playbook right now. But when I get the chance, man, I definitely want to come on." So I'm like, "All right." So from that day on, I can never talk bad about Mitch Trubisky, right? That's the only way for me not to talk bad about you is if you give me empty compliments. So shout out to Mitch Trubisky's big
guy. Hey, there's no reason to talk bad about him. I think he's been playing really well. And to me, the measure of a young quarterback is, are you improving every week? And clearly he is. He had an outstanding game. I mean, 6 touchdowns, 350 plus yards passing. That's awesome. Outstanding. Shout out also to Matt Nagy, the head coach, who came in there, and Trubisky basically was the ultimate don't fuck up guy last year. Whatever you do, don't throw any interceptions. Don't fumble the ball. We're just going to take you extremely slowly and conservatively when you have the ball. And all of a sudden now they have turned him into like what Patrick Mahomes is in Kansas City, where he's thrown 6 touchdowns in a game. That's pretty amazing.
Taylor Gabriel went for 104 yards and 2 receiving touchdowns.
That's not bad.
Shout out to my guy, T. Gabriel. You know what I don't like? Real quick.
Okay, let's tell me.
Before we get into it, I hate the narrative that the Browns cut Taylor Gabriel for me.
What happened?
They cut him because it was a dumb move. I was pissed that we got rid of Taylor Gabriel. But Taylor Gabriel just doesn't play the slot. People just assume because you're short, you're a slot receiver, which is heightism, and I'm not going to stand for it.
Usually true.
But it's
a stereotype. But it's we don't do stereotypes.
It's like people talk to me and they call me a returner. I've never returned a kick in the NFL. I am not a returner. I'm just a really short receiver. That is not, it's another football stereotype. But Taylor Gabriel didn't play the slot. The slots were me and Higgins that year. But they, remember, they drafted 4 receivers and then they kept all rookies. And that was the year me and you were so frustrated because we cut so many veterans that should have been on the team, that would have made our team not just a little better, way better. And that was one of those in the year, in the couple years of analytics-driven football that was, oh, we're just going to kick all our draft picks. And, you know, and that was all the losses. That's what it's a direct result of, that you lose incredible players like Taylor Gabriel, who's making a crazy amount of money, like $8 million a year or something crazy like that.
You're jealous.
I am super jealous. Like, if that was the result, you should have cut me. I would love to go trick somebody to give me $8 million a year. But shout out to Taylor Gabriel, man. That's one of my studs of the week.
All right. Let's move into the next segment, and that is the Nobel Peace Prize award-winning edition of Am I Tripping? Zerm, why don't you intro these for us?
Is that your Dosh bibs?
That's my mosh ribs.
Mosh ribs, that's what it was.
Hey, man. Yo, man. Am I dripping, dog?
We need to we'll have Natalie put together all these all those sounds into one Am I Tripping intro. But yeah, big news for Am I Tripping is it just won the Nobel Peace Prize Award. So really, it's really doing, our segments are really doing big things for us.
That's our fourth one.
It is. It's really
since we've started the Tomahawk Show.
It's truly unbelievable. All right, guys. Am I tripping, or do we have a new candidate for worst roughing the passer call of the year already in week 4? Now, Joe, you have been at the forefront of the former player pushback against these calls. But man, yesterday's call against Arden Key on Baker Mayfield was pretty bad. So do we already have a new candidate for worst roughing the passer call of the year?
Yes, and I put this on my Twitter at JoeThomas73. Clay Matthews needs to stop whining and complaining about the three ridiculous roughing the passer calls that he got in the first 3 weeks of the season, because Arden Key is now at the top of the heap. What Clay Matthews did was akin to torture to those quarterbacks in the first 3 weeks compared to what Arden Key bumped Baker Mayfield with. He didn't even hit him with his head. He like bumped him barely with his chest, his shoulder pads. Not even enough to really redirect Baker Mayfield's motion. I don't even know how you could possibly call roughing the passer, but the ridiculous rule and the way the NFL is asking the refs to officiate roughing the passer has caused a bump into a quarterback to turn into a roughing the passer 15-yard call. And the crazy thing about this call was the people that were watching at home, like myself, and the people that were on the field didn't even realize what had happened, because they didn't even recognize that the quarterback got bumped. So it's not even in your head, it's not even in your brain process to think there could be a penalty. And the ref kind of called it in the middle of a long completion, and we didn't even know. And honestly, I don't think that the vast majority of people even realized what had happened. It was that ridiculous. Dude,
that was one of the worst calls. That's why I say, when we talk about the bad breaks the Browns got, that we got to just stay the course, because imagine if that would have been determined the outcome of the game in favor of the Browns. Like, how could we, with good conscience, say that that wasn't a horrible call? That might have been the worst call that I've ever seen in football. And it's on the rundown because I said it yesterday. It has me reconsidering my love for football. That was one of those moments. We've all had an ex, right? Ex-boyfriend, ex-girlfriend, that, let's say they're a bit crazy, right? And you always reach that moment. There's always one time where you look at them, they do something or say something or react to something, and you kind of just give a pause. And you just look at him and think, wow, this motherfucker's crazy. This isn't going to work, is it? You don't say it, but it's just in your mind. You just know, like, from that point, it's like, oh, man, I gotta get out of here. That was as close to the moment in football as I got of on-field play calls yesterday with that call. Because it was like, oh, man, this isn't the same football that I know anymore. And it was disheartening, man. That was terrible. If that's the way this league is going. And this is from a receiver who doesn't like people hitting me. I don't like physical contact. That's not what I'm here for. I'm here to make guys miss. That was still a terrible play call.
Guys, when the Browns game went to overtime yesterday, I let out a very loud groan because I'm over overtime games in the NFL. So am I tripping or are NFL overtime games, which we've already had six of somehow in 4 weeks, are they the worst?
They are the worst. We should start flipping coins. From now on, into regulation, if it's a tie game, captains come to the middle, flip a coin. Whoever wins the coin toss wins the football game. Let's all get out of here, man. I'm sick of it. This is ridiculous. We shouldn't have as many overtime games.
Oh, Hawk, you're an idiot. You are tripping, because I love overtime games, but the only thing that's giving NFL fans pause when the game goes into overtime is that fear that they're going to see another freaking tie. And honestly, if we were able to eliminate the ties and go with the strategy that I've talked about, which is, hey, at the end of overtime regulation, which is like 10 minutes right now, give each team an opportunity from the 2-yard line, a 2-point conversion. And if both teams make it, then you move the ball back to the 5-yard line, and you keep doing that until one team makes it and one team misses. So you go 2, 5, 10, 15, and you just keep moving it back 5 yards, so on and so forth, until one team makes it and the other team doesn't. So you never have to end in a tie. Then people wouldn't be afraid of overtimes again.
Yeah, no, I just like the coin toss, or someone donate their firstborn or something. Whoever's willing to donate a firstborn, they get the W. All right, what else we got, Firm?
All right, final one of this award-winning Am I Trippin' segment. Yesterday, Golden Tate scored a touchdown, and on his way into the end zone, he turned all the way around to taunt the defensive backs that were chasing him. Now, this is
I think he did it twice.
I think he did do it twice. This is something we've seen from Tyreek Hill, who's been throwing up the peace sign as he goes in the end zone. Even last week, I believe, two players high-fived each other on their way into the end zone. So, guys, am I tripping, or is the taunt before you get into the end zone move, is it a little unprofessional?
You know what? It's very unprofessional, very unsportsmanlike, but I love it, to be honest. And maybe this is my diva wide receiver talking, but if you don't like it, you should stop me. You should hit me. You should tackle me. You should try to prevent me from being able to do it. And if you can't, then yes, Cheetah, throw up the peace sign. Yes, Tate, backpedal into the end zone. Yes, high five your friend if people aren't fast enough to be around to make a tackle. There was even a guy in Chicago that ran a route. The defensive backs busted. He threw his hand up to Mitch Trubisky and then gave the touchdown sign before he caught it. He gave the touchdown sign, caught it, and ran in the end zone.
All right.
I'm for it.
I'm for it with one caveat. I love the celebrating before you get in the end zone. I love when Tyreek Hill throws up the deuce because he's so fast and he's always just outrunning everybody. That's great. That's exciting. I love the high five before you get in the end zone. What I don't like is when you take it too far, like Golden Tate did, and you're blatantly taunting the other team in a very disrespectful manner. I don't like that, but I do love a little bit of celebration, having a little bit of fun before you get into the end zone.
Taking it from a guy who's just like, I've never taken a snap. There's one guy on this podcast who's never scored a touchdown, Firm.
This is true. And I believe his name rhymes with Mo Mamas. All right, guys. Yeah, as we
good friends with Josh Mims.
Yes.
Mosh ribs.
I keep getting it wrong.
All right, guys, let's wrap this up. For both of you, it is time for our Tomahawk Studs of the Week. Hawk, why don't we start with you?
I'm going with Mitch Trubisky, who threw 6 touchdown passes. Prior to this week, he had only one game where he threw multiple touchdown passes, which happened 2 weeks ago. And then he comes out here versus the hot Tampa Bay Buccaneers and throws 6 TD passes. Cleveland native. Congrats, Mitch. You are the Hawk portion of the Tomahawk Show Stud of the Week.
The Tama Stud of the Week is Blake Bortles, right? The guy that was left for dead a couple years ago. I mean, people couldn't wait to get rid of this guy, call him a bust. He's horrible. All of a sudden, a new coach comes into Jacksonville. All of a sudden, their defense starts playing pretty good. And this guy looks like he's a stud all of a sudden, a Tomahawk stud, as a matter of fact. He is playing lights out right now. That Jacksonville team is dangerous at 3-1. Blake Bortles, listen to this stat line, 29 of 38, 388 yards, 2 TDs, 1 pick, only sacked twice. An amazing game for Blake Bortles, friend of the show. He is turning himself into a big-time quarterback, and he is my Tomahawk Stud of the Week.
There are certain worlds I don't want to live in. Somebody asked me yesterday about LeBron having control of the Lakers because Luke Walton is the coach. I said, I don't want to live in a world where Luke Walton tells LeBron James what to do. And I also don't want to live in a world where Blake Bortles consistently throws for 350 plus yards passing. Something is wrong with our NFL.
Hey, this is our reality. This is our new reality right now. Blake Bortles is a good quarterback.
The world is changing right in front of us, Joe. Well, look, I think that does it for today's episode of the Tomahawk Show. Make sure you tweet us at Tomahawk Show. Hit us up on Instagram at Tomahawk Show. Hit us with the hashtag Tomahawk. Make sure you join our DraftKings League. We will get into the winners next episode. We will also talk about Jimbo Fisher next episode, who went a little overboard in our opinion on one of his players, but we'll get into that. Subscribe, rate 5 stars. We are here every Monday, every Thursday. I think that's it. Joe, final thoughts.
Hawk, my final thoughts, and this is because you got me thinking with your Tomahawk Stud of the Week. Mitch Trubisky had 5 touchdown passes in the first half. That is truly amazing. The Bears got something going on right now. They got probably the best defense in the NFL. Thanks to John Gruden, who gave
shout out to Gruden.
Thank you. And that was just amazing. They've started to put things together. I'm happy for those fans in Chicago. Great professional sports fans, great football fans. The Bears should be one of those teams, just like the Browns, that should be good every year because it makes the NFL fun to watch and it's good for the game.
Okay, Matt Nagy just texted me and said your check is in the mail. Thank you all for listening to the Tomahawk Show. Nat, take us out.
Joe, hawk yourself.